Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Did the uneasy compromise of the Berlin Wall prevent nuclear war between East and West, or simply entrench both sides in a Cold War that might otherwise have thawed far sooner? Americans fondly remember President Kennedy's historic Ich bin ein Berliner speech of 1963, and we are grateful to have avoided what might have been a devastating fight over Soviet missile base construction in Cuba in 1962. But those memories overshadow the fact that Kennedy's first year in office was marked, in his own estimation, by a series of disasters, and in my guest's opinion, by an equally dangerous series of rookie mistakes. Frederick Kemp is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council and a 25-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. Fred, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. Great to be on.
So you made use of newly declassified evidence in drawing conclusions for this book. Can you talk about some of the things you were able to study and learn that had not been thoroughly explored by previous researchers?
Well, partly I found some new things, but partly I just put together pieces that were already there that hadn't been used in any other book, bringing together Soviet documents, German documents, and U.S. documents. And I think what you do is, if you put together the pieces from the Soviet side, from the U.S. side, from the West German side, and the East German side, you have a series of miscommunications, misunderstandings, and I think probably the most controversial point I reach is that it was one of the worst first-year foreign policy performances, first inaugural year foreign policy performance of any modern U.S. president.
Well, we should step back here to talk about the foreign policy positions that Kennedy had essentially locked himself into in order to get elected. He took, in many cases, more hawkish stands than his opponent Richard Nixon in the 1960 campaign.
Yeah, very interesting, and it grows partly out of his father. His father was an anti-communist. He was, of course, a very well-off man, but also the ambassador to London. Kennedy was also from the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party in terms of being anti-communist, probably would not have won his election in 1960 against Nixon if he hadn't taken a harder line toward the Soviets and toward communism than Nixon did.
And on the other side, talk about the pressure that Nikita Khrushchev faced at home in terms of the positions that he would ultimately take with regard to Berlin.
I think this is one of the more interesting points in the book, and I think it also has messages for today, and that is foreign policy is ultimately driven by domestic politics, even for authoritarian countries. So whether it's Iran today or whether it's the Soviet Union 50 years ago, it's important to know the domestic politics, even though they're very opaque for authoritarian countries. And for Khrushchev, he had a new rising attack from Stalinist remnants in his own party and from Mao Zedong of China, and both of them were arguing that he was not being tough enough toward the United States. There had been the shooting down in May of 1960, the Soviet shooting down of a U-2 spy plane, the U.S. spy plane. That would seem to be a triumph for Khrushchev, but instead his enemies within his own party, who had never really forgiven him for denouncing Stalin and Stalin's crimes, saw this as a sign of Khrushchev's weakness, that despite the fact that he was trying to reach agreements with President Eisenhower and with the U.S., there they were flying spy planes over Soviet territory. So that really put him in a position where he had to defend himself against hardliners in his own party, even as he tried to reach out to Kennedy in the first days of the Kennedy administration.
How did that denunciation of Stalin complicate his relationship with the leader of East Germany?
His survival depended on the survival of East Germany. East Germany was his westernmost outpost. The leader of East Germany, Walter Ulbricht, was one of the last remaining Stalinists. I mean, one of the reasons I really loved writing this book is from my time at the Wall Street Journal. I just like gripping characters and wonderful events. And these you can't make these characters up. A Hollywood producer couldn't make them up. You have on the Soviet side a 67-year-old son of peasants had battled his way through World War II, through Stalin purges, Nikita Khrushchev. On the other side, a 43-year-old son of privilege, Kennedy. You mentioned Walter Ulbricht, the East German leader. He distrusts Khrushchev entirely, thinks Khrushchev is not strong enough toward the U.S., is not doing enough to help him stop a refugee outflow from East Germany that's threatening to bring down the country, and that's what the Berlin Wall is all about in August. And then on the West German side, you have Konrad Adenauer, 85 years old, really the person who's built the West German economic and political miracle on the ashes of the Third Reich. And he distrusts Kennedy every bit as much as Ulbricht distrusts Khrushchev, doesn't think Kennedy has got the stuff to stand up to Soviet brutality. So you really have fascinating dynamics among the four principal characters of this story.
And Kennedy, in some ways, had sort of written Adenauer off as someone who was really important to pay attention to.
Well, here's Kennedy, 43 years old. Adenauer's 85 years old. One is left-of-center politician. The other one's right-of-center. Adenauer was very close to President Truman, very close to President Eisenhower, both of whom considered him a great man of history. Kennedy considers him a shadow of the past. He even writes that in a foreign affairs article while he was a senator. And, of course, this article was distributed in West Germany, so all of Konrad Adenauer's lieutenants knew how Kennedy felt about him. And he was looking to the Berlin mayor, Willy Brandt, who was roughly his same age, patterned himself as a bit of a West German Kennedy. He was looking to him to be the future, but of course that created a lot of distrust between these two leaders.
All right, we should talk in some more detail about the situation in Berlin in 1960 and 1961 before the wall went up. You alluded to this earlier. People were streaming over that border from East to West Germany in numbers that were essentially unsustainable for the East.
Yeah, now, I mean, let's set this up a little bit. 1945, the war ends, so this is only 16 years after the end of World War II. Between 1945 and 1961, 2.8 million Eastern Germans leave the Soviet zone, leave East Germany. And that's a country that in 1961 was only 17 million, so a huge percentage has already left. What really brings it to a crisis in 1961 is that the refugee numbers are increasing because the West German economy is getting stronger, producing jobs left and right, and the East German economy is getting weaker. So comparatively, it just looks much better to be in West Germany. And then on top of that, you have a situation where Kennedy has sent messages, or at least is being perceived by Khrushchev as being weak. So you have a heightening situation of refugee outflow, and you have a perception on the part of Khrushchev through the Bay of Pigs, and we can get back to that Bay of Pigs invasion, the botched Bay of Pigs invasion in April, and then a Vienna summit in June, that Kennedy is weak and indecisive. As you said in your opening comments, this is also something that Kennedy himself admits later on in the year, that he's had a very bad year in that respect.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the Bay of Pigs. What's interesting about this is that obviously it was a disastrous failure for the United States by any account. But the plans for the operation had not even originated under Kennedy's watch.
What's important to me about the Bay of Pigs and also the Vienna summit is not how we look at it or how Kennedy looked at it, but really how Khrushchev looked at it. And so he compares the botched Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961. And don't forget, this was a CIA-backed invasion of Cuban exiles. There was no U.S. equipment used, no U.S. soldiers used. And Khrushchev looks at that and sees, first of all, that Kennedy didn't have the presidential courage to either cancel the invasion altogether, and as you said, it was hatched during the Eisenhower administration, or give it the strength to succeed. And Khrushchev compares this unfavorably to his own actions in Hungary in 1956, where he sends in Soviet tanks to put down an uprising in Hungary. And then just 6 weeks later, Kennedy comes to the Vienna summit with Khrushchev, and Khrushchev only really agrees to the summit after the Bay of Pigs, so he knows he's in a stronger position, and after he's put the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. So he comes to the summit on a high. Kennedy comes to the summit trying to prove himself in foreign policy terms, and by Kennedy's own estimation, by the end of the summit, he says to the New York Times columnist Scotty Reston, that Khrushchev savaged him. Kennedy called it the worst day of his life.
What had the goals been for the summit?
At the summit?
At the Vienna summit. What were they
well,
specifically?
Well, that's the problem, is they went in with different goals. Kennedy came into the summit wanting to get to know Khrushchev, wanting to reduce tensions, wanting, you know, he came in with no real agenda. They only had 5-6 weeks to put together this hugely important summit. He thought he went into the summit with an agreement that nothing major would be discussed on Berlin. But instead of that, Khrushchev delivers him an ultimatum on the second day of the summit that he's going to change the status quo of Berlin unilaterally if Kennedy won't negotiate a new status with him. And so he gets Kennedy gets ambushed on that. Kennedy was also told by his advisors that he should not engage Khrushchev in any ideological debate. Kennedy believed, because of his education, because of how strongly he felt about the freedom of the United States, that he could win that kind of ideological debate. But instead, on day one of the summit, Khrushchev totally monopolizes play, almost like a soccer team that just controls the ball the entire time. And Kennedy really gets beat up on the ideological debate as well.
We should step back here and make the point that from the very beginning of the Kennedy administration, or at the very beginning, Khrushchev had made several attempts to mollify the United States and its allies, and Kennedy somehow overlooked or underreacted to these attempts.
See, I think that's a very important point. But let me just go back to one thing on the Vienna summit.
Sure.
This book is not a tabloid treatment of Kennedy and Khrushchev. This is a serious historical treatment. So I tried to stay away from the stories of Kennedy's womanizing, his health problems, except for where I thought it made a difference. And at the Vienna summit, it well may have made a difference. He was in terrible pain going into that summit. Along on the ride to Vienna and to Paris, right ahead of Vienna, was a doctor who was a doctor to celebrities in New York, Truman Capote, Tennessee Williams, and he was known by the nickname Dr. Feelgood. His real name was Max Jacobson. He was shooting Kennedy full of shots that included enzymes, steroids, animal organ cells, and importantly, amphetamines. The side effects of these shots, which we know about what was in the shots because they were later tested by the FDA at the request of his brother Bobby Kennedy, the side effects could be mood swings, they could be nervousness, they could be impaired judgment. So you saw some of those tendencies of Kennedy after the summit. Certainly that's not the kind of person you want going into a negotiation with Khrushchev.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and I don't mean to make light of this, but you know, substances that would have gotten him kicked out of Major League Baseball. he's there, you know, running the most one of the most important countries in the world.
Yeah, they don't drug test the commander in chief before a summit meeting with the Soviet leader. You're absolutely right. But back to your question about this happened on what you were asking about in terms of Kennedy's misjudgment about some gestures that the Soviet leader extended to him on his first day in office.
And you know, Fred, I'm so sorry. We're going to take a quick break here, so I'm going to jump in before you get rolling on that, on answering that part of the question, and we'll come back in a couple of minutes. My guest this hour is Frederick Kemp. He is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council and a 25-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can be part of it by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also ask a question via email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick Kemp. He is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council and a 25-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. So, Fred, going back to what we set up before the break, there is not necessarily an incredibly bellicose attitude by Khrushchev as Kennedy came into office, but Kennedy really paid no attention to the signs that he sent. Talk about, first of all, the things that Khrushchev did to send the message that he wanted peace.
Well, first of all, there is a message here, too, for America now. And that is, the first year of any new president is a problematic year for the United States because there really is no way to prepare yourself for this office. And we very often elect people who are young and relatively inexperienced, like President Kennedy, like President Obama. So President Kennedy comes into office. Khrushchev has got an interest in peaceful coexistence with the U.S., has problems with his own hard right that Kennedy really doesn't know about, reaches out to Kennedy by releasing captured U.S. airmen, prints the entire inaugural address, Kennedy's entire inaugural address, which was unprecedented in the Soviet Union, prints it in Izvestia Pravda to Soviet newspapers, reduces the jamming of Voice of America, allows the Jewish theater to open in Moscow, a number of gestures. Kennedy instead is focused on a speech that Khrushchev had given on January 9th, so 2 weeks before his inauguration. That speech, if you read it literally, reads like a declaration or an escalation of the Cold War across the developing world. If you're Kennedy and you're new to office, you can look at this as directly aimed at you, something you should be very fearful of. That's what Kennedy does. So he responds to that instead of the gestures. Even though now we know that that Khrushchev was speaking to propagandists, ideologists, he was merely reporting on a meeting of communist parties from the previous November where he was trying to settle a dispute with the Chinese. And it was really routine rhetoric. So he misses what might have been the most important or the most promising moment in his administration to reach out and test a gesture from Khrushchev. I call it in a chapter in the book, Kennedy's First Mistake.
You know, one of the reasons that our new presidents have large teams of advisors is to help them navigate this new world that they step into. What did the folks who were working with Kennedy tell him or not tell him about the reality in the Soviet Union?
Again, things don't change that much from one administration to another administration. His administration was divided. Mm-hmm. There was interagency conflict over just how tough to be with the Soviet Union. On the one hand, Kennedy had brought in Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State, to Truman, who was doing a review on Berlin policy and NATO policy. Acheson was a hawk, was, of course, a great man of history. On his side was a Pentagon official named Paul Nitze. Most of the Berlin task force and people working the Berlin issue, they were hardliners regarding the Soviets in Berlin. They disparagingly called the softliners the slobs. The acronym was Softliners on Berlin. Hmm. Adlai Stevenson, Averell Harriman, also some very well-known names. And they were giving Kennedy conflicting advice about how to approach the Soviets right up until the time of the construction of the Berlin Wall and thereafter.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ken on the line in Plano. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm really curious to know if your guest has seen some of the interviews that Sergei Khrushchev, the son of Nikita Khrushchev, has said about his father. And I think they're sort of unpopular in that they very much humanize a man who is dealing with a much more severe politics. And he basically feels that it was his father, not Kennedy, who saved the world that day when they found themselves confronting each other during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I wonder where you sort of land on this issue. Thank you very much.
Let me take it in two pieces. First of all, the Cuban Missile Crisis. I do call 1961 one of the worst presidential performances in first-year performances of any modern president. People criticize me on that because they come back and say, well, but look what a wonderful president he became, and look how he stood up to Khrushchev over the Cuban Missile Crisis. My argument, which I support with evidence in the book and pretty strong evidence of the book, is that Khrushchev never would have risked the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 if he had not concluded during 1961 through the Bay of Pigs, through the Vienna summit, and through the Berlin Wall that Kennedy could be had. He even told his son Sergei, and I quote Sergei quite a bit in the book, he told his son Sergei that Kennedy would belatedly see the weapons were in Cuba, he would huff and puff, and he would huff and puff, but he wouldn't do anything. Second thing on Sergei, I think if you take Sergei Khrushchev's early statements and early writings about his father, I think they're pretty reliable, and I used quite a bit of that. I think the further you get away from an event and the documents and the recollections of the event at that time, the more danger there is that any eyewitness, whether it's Sergei Khrushchev or another eyewitness, is likely to color the event or color reminiscences a little bit. So I paid a lot more attention to what Sergei said more closely to the events of 61.
Another thing you write about here is these back-channel communications that were set up between Bobby Kennedy and I guess, a Soviet spy, which might have seemed to the Americans to be a good way of sort of getting messages back and forth, but in fact were inherently unequal, conducted between people who were inherently unequal. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I pay more attention to this relationship, I think, than any previous book about that period. What happens is after the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy and his brother, Bobby, who was Attorney General, come to mistrust their military establishment, their intelligence establishment. They want a different way of communicating with Khrushchev. They find it in a Soviet military spy named Georgi Bolshakov, quite a colorful character himself, and not a very secret spy. He was very much part of Washington society, friendly with Ben Bradley, a real bon vivant. His cover was as press spokesperson for the Soviet embassy. This is a very interesting conduit. On the one hand, they could relay messages privately back and forth, but Kennedy exposes himself because Bobby Kennedy knows his brother's inner heart. He can reveal things about President Kennedy, perhaps even inadvertently, while the Soviet spy can only be a message carrier. He can't really know what Khrushchev is really feeling or thinking, and so he's being a message carrier. The other thing is he would be schooled and trained in the art of deception, and Bobby Kennedy, of course, had not spent his life doing that sort of thing, so it was an uneven relationship.
So what sort of advantage did that give to the Soviets?
I think ahead of the Vienna summit, it allowed them to send a message, oh, we're not going to make a very big deal about Berlin. Mm-hmm. We will engage you seriously on talks about a nuclear test ban treaty, which is what Kennedy wanted. And when they got to Berlin, it didn't turn out that way at all. He did deliver quite a tough message and ultimatum on Berlin. And he really didn't give Kennedy any ground on nuclear weapons or a nuclear test ban. There was a later showdown of tanks October after the building of the Berlin Wall in August. In October, a showdown of tanks, the first time you had Soviet and U.S. tanks and fighting men arrayed across from each other at Checkpoint Charlie. Long story about how it came to that, but it was an escalation over a test of whether or not the U.S. was going to accept a change of four-power procedures after the wall went up, where East German forces were inspecting Allied identity cards at the border. It may seem arcane, but at that time, General Clay, who had come back to Berlin after the wall went up, was testing and trying to reinforce four-power rights. The reason I bring up this whole story is it was diffused. The tanks backed down on both sides, but it happened after secret discussions between Bolshakov and Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy talks about this in his oral history of the John F. Kennedy Library. He says that Bolshakov was instrumental in helping him defuse that crisis. But then he apologizes that in all these meetings he had with the Soviet spy, and they were often two or three times a month during 1961, he always reported orally to Kennedy. So we don't have a written record of these talks, and the story is mostly told through accounts of Bolshakov later on, and very little from the U.S. side.
Another really strong claim you make here, Fred, is that Kennedy essentially wrote the script that Khrushchev ultimately followed with regard to East Germany and the Berlin Wall. Can you talk about that?
Yes. What we know is at the Vienna summit, Kennedy sends a quite different message from his predecessors regarding Berlin. He says, essentially, if you don't disturb access to West Berlin, the freedom of West Berlin, you can do virtually whatever you want within East Berlin. Mm-hmm. And it's important to note that the Berlin Wall was built entirely within East Berlin territory. It didn't cross into the West Berlin side. And even in the first 48 hours, it was really only barbed wire and temporary structures and men. And only 9 days later did the actual structure of a Berlin Wall be built, as the Soviets and the East Germans watched to see what U.S. reaction would be. What Kennedy believed, and you can understand his logic here. He was very worried about nuclear war. It worried him more than anything else. And what he believed is if he could allow the East Berlin situation to be diffused, if he allowed Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev to solve his East Berlin refugee problem, that he might gain a more cooperative negotiating partner for issues that he thought were much larger issues, which were issues of avoiding nuclear war. My argument is that even if he thought that, the fact that you had an escalation after the Berlin Wall was built, you had Khrushchev testing a 50-megaton bomb, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis a year later, I conclude that he didn't create a safer situation in August of 1961. He created a more dangerous situation that only then became safer after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
With regard to the construction of the wall itself, given that it did fall entirely on East German territory, I mean, according to international law and treaty, would Kennedy have had any rights to take physical action to prevent or halt the construction of the wall?
He would have, though by his interpretation at the time, he decided not to use the excuse he would have had. Under four power rights, East German forces, soldiers, and were not allowed to operate in East Berlin at all. And so the very presence of East German forces, and it wasn't the Soviets that built the wall, it wasn't the Soviets that closed the border, it really was East Germans mm-hmm. who, under four power rights, did not have the right to operate in East Berlin at all. You could have also technically argued that they were interrupting access between East and West Berlin. But the interesting thing is the East German soldiers were very careful not to do that. They kept crossing points open, and even during the night that the Berlin border was being closed, East German forces were allowing American diplomats to cross and inspect what was going on. So, again, very clearly, they've heard the message from Kennedy, if you don't interrupt access to West Berlin, and if you don't interrupt the freedom of West Berlin, what you do within your own territory is your business. And so they acted very much within the guardrails that Kennedy and the Kennedy administration had laid down.
What convinces you that there would not have been a quick escalation to hot war, potentially nuclear war, if the Americans and their allies had taken physical action at the Berlin Wall?
The introduction to my book, written by General Scowcroft, General Brent Scowcroft, two-time National Security Advisor, he says very wisely that history doesn't reveal its alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll really never know. The one thing I don't do in my book is this is not a neoconservative book. I'm not calling for war to be fought over Berlin. Between between the lines of the book and in my epilogue, I think the argument is more that Kennedy had opportunities where he could have sent different messages to Khrushchev that I think might have prevented the building of a Berlin Wall. For example, if at the Vienna summit he had sent a message, don't change four power rights at all. We can't countenance anything that changes the current status of Berlin. Or even if he had started to engage Khrushchev in negotiations, while at the same time sending these tough messages, there were any number of other approaches he could have taken. So I'm not saying I know how history would have turned out. I'm arguing that we know how history did turn out, and that is that by acquiescing to the building of the Berlin Wall, we ended up with a Cuban Missile Crisis, and we ended up with 30 more years of Cold War, 28 years to be specific. The Berlin Wall comes down in 1989. And when it was built, there's no way that President Kennedy could have known that it would even come down 28 years later.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Howard on the line in Denton. Hi, Howard.
Hi. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one Saturday, I had several trailers come through that I couldn't even open up to check what was in it because it was destined to Florida. It had military escorts, so I couldn't even open the envelope to see what was on the waybill. The tractors were pulled into to our gassing facilities. The trailers were left on the lot, and then they were rehooked up, and they were gone.
Scary time in history. Thank you so much for your call, Howard. My guest this hour is Frederick Kemp, president and CEO of the Atlantic Council and a 25-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick Kemp, president and CEO of the Atlantic Council and a 25-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Fred, did Kennedy sincerely believe that it was either the wall and accept the wall or risk nuclear war?
He certainly said that afterward, but I think he was more, I think it was more that he knew he wasn't willing to go to nuclear war over Berlin. And the Soviets would not have been able to reach at that point the U.S. territory in any reliable manner with nuclear weapons. And we knew that. We newly knew that through our overhead photography. That's part of the reason why Khrushchev, that's a large part of the reason why Khrushchev wanted to have nuclear weapons in Cuba so that he could reach Washington, could reach New York, which he couldn't do previously. We also had seen through previous interactions with the Soviets, including Cuba thereafter, that this is not something they would have been likely to go to nuclear war over. We don't know for sure. That said, what Kennedy did believe is he didn't think the Allies would stand by him if he had to engage in a conflict over Berlin. And tactically, in terms of conventional weapons, the Soviets had huge superiority around the area of Berlin, so he would have had no other alternative than to escalate to nuclear war had the Soviets decided to escalate. So I think there are a lot of interesting questions around that, but I think it was much more complicated than I'd rather, which is what Kennedy said, I'd rather have a wall than a war.
Talk about the extent to which, in his first year in office, Kennedy's actions and failures to act ultimately really legitimized Soviet control.
There's no doubt that the U.S. accepted the division of Europe de facto after the post-World War II treaties. But what Kennedy did was he, in the Vienna summit and in the actions over the Berlin Wall, he just made it clearer. Now, we have to remember at that time we were more worried about Soviet expansion than we were concerned with Soviet rollback. So on the one hand, one can understand that. On the other hand, it was clear that East Germany was imploding. And it was imploding because of a refugee outflow. And it was a refugee outflow 28 years later in East Germany that began or helped speed the end of the Soviet Empire. The Soviet Empire still had a lot more energy at that time. It had a lot more staying power. It wasn't as exhausted as it was under Mikhail Gorbachev later. But nevertheless, we were in a situation where Kennedy, because he had larger issues in mind than the issue of Berlin, was willing to accept the status quo of division in Eastern Europe, says it more clearly in Vienna, says it more clearly in cables through his Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, after the building of the Berlin Wall than had his predecessors.
Is it fair to say that he ultimately really didn't care about the fates of the people who were divided by that wall?
I don't think it's that he didn't care about them. I think it's that he didn't have the same emotional attachment than his predecessors did.
Mm-hmm.
For him, the freedom of East Berlin wasn't as important as avoiding nuclear war. What's interesting, of course, is he starts shifting. He shifts through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and in the period of time between the Berlin Wall and the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy is still testing Khrushchev. He still wants to do a deal on nuclear weapons. If you look at his very famous speech before the United Nations, the Sword of Damocles speech, after the building of the Berlin Wall, he's still reaching out. He's still trying to do a deal to reduce the nuclear threat. It's really through the Cuban Missile Crisis and the aftermath that Kennedy crosses the line. And then he goes to Berlin in 1963, and he rewrites his speech while going through the crowded streets of Berlin, where he's being cheered like a gladiator, and that's when he stands in front of the Berliners and says, "Ich bin ein Berliner." He says, "I'm a Berliner. All free men have to call themselves Berliners." But what we forget is that's 1963. That's 2 years after 1961. And he wouldn't have given that kind of emotional speech if he hadn't gone through the experiences that brought him there. And at that point, he comes to care about the people of East Berlin and Berlin and Eastern Europe in a much different way. But it's the evolution of his presidency. He finally finds his voice on these issues.
I want to go back, when we talk about finding his voice, to the comments you made earlier about the importance of looking at the first year of every president. Obviously, the early time of the Obama administration is most salient now because he is president. Is he any less qualified than the young and relatively inexperienced presidents Bush and Clinton that preceded him?
I think the point that I'd make is that at historic inflection points, and 1961 was a historic inflection point, and I think the Mideast upheavals make 2011, 50 years later, just as important, perhaps even more important. At these sorts of times, presidential decisions have outsized importance. Obama is facing this time the third year of his presidency. The action he took to kill Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, I wonder how he would have handled that sort of situation in the first year of his presidency.
Hmm.
One doesn't know. But you are watching a President Obama who is finding more of his voice. If you listen to his recent Mideast speech, if you look at his response to Osama bin Laden. On the other hand, how he's responded to Libya, I think, has some comparative qualities to the Bay of Pigs, insofar as he neither accepted the advice of many or some of those in his cabinet not to intervene at all, which Kennedy also didn't take the advice not to intervene at all, but he also did not take the advice to intervene in a decisive manner in the first days. So I think we're seeing presidents do learn on the job, and we don't know what sort of lessons that Obama will take from the Osama bin Laden episode. We don't know what kind of leadership he'll show through these Mideast upheavals. In some ways, a much more complicated time than what was 1961. But we do know how these things grow from one to the other. Berlin, the Bay of Pigs, the Vienna summit, the Berlin border being closed, the Cuban Missile Crisis growing out of that. So that was 1962 after 1961. We'll have to see what 2012 brings after 2011.
It makes perfect sense that people learn on the job. I mean, I think I'm better at my job than I was in the first year. Is there a better way to educate and prepare incoming presidents than what we have in place now and what we have had in place for the past several decades?
Well, maybe this should be another book. I think there is. I think, in many countries of the world, the top tiers of your foreign policy team stay in office from one administration to another, even from one party to another. Mm-hmm. When we have transitions, the entire top leadership, State Department, Pentagon, the CIA director, often gets replaced. And it's particularly stark when you go from one party to another. And so I think you can't ever assure that the president you elect is going to have all the skills you need in the presidency. But you can ensure that he's surrounded by people who have historical knowledge. I've talked to a lot of people in Washington about this since I wrote the book, and some of them are shocked when they come into power that many of the documents they most need to see have moved off to presidential libraries, are not easily found, and they have to do a lot of learning on the job. So we really need to improve the transition, and we need to keep more people, I would think, in positions of influence to help people coming into important jobs when a new president is elected.
Is it possible, just as a thought exercise, to imagine that maybe we didn't have to have the kind of Cold War we had Kennedy taken very specifically different steps just simply in his first year in office?
Yeah, I think we have a tendency very often to see things in black and white and the evil Soviet Union and the good Americans. And there's no doubt that the Soviet system was much more repressive. There's no doubt that there were political prisoners and that we were on the sunny side of history. On the other hand, by simplifying things too much, we actually underestimated the extent to which Nikita Khrushchev wanted to reform his system. Now, he was an erratic reformer. He wasn't a particularly well-educated reformer, but he understood that his agricultural system did not work as well as what he had seen in the United States. He understood that he couldn't really afford a military confrontation with the U.S. That's the reason he wanted peaceful coexistence. And you see a lot of this in the cables, but then you didn't see a lot of it reflected in the subtlety. You didn't see a lot of this subtlety reflected in media reports at the time and the statements of public officials. So I think we would do ourselves well to look at our adversaries in a more nuanced fashion and understand a little bit also where they're coming from. I think we could have guided a much more intelligent policy toward Khrushchev, particularly after his break with Stalinism in 1956.
If you don't mind talking about this, something that's a bit personal, what happened in East Germany, in fact, affected some members of your family?
Yes, in fact, this book, there are all sorts of intellectual and academic reasons I wanted to write this book. I'm fascinated with the Cold War. I think this was the decisive year and the decisive place of the Cold War. But it also grew out of my personal history. Most of my relatives were German, and the majority of my German relatives lived in East Germany. I visited them when I was a student. So it was the first time that I confronted a situation of visiting people who were unfree. They were fearful to talk to me, even though I was just a student. They worried that their neighbors were trying to listen into their conversations. I hadn't seen people live in that sort of constant state of it wasn't a dramatic fear. It was just there all the time. They couldn't travel freely. They couldn't read what magazines they wanted to. And then as a young reporter for Newsweek and then the Wall Street Journal, I covered the birth of solidarity in Poland. And for the first time in my life, I saw tens of thousands of people willing to risk their careers to fight for freedoms that I, as an American, had always taken for granted. So, I come about my interest in the Cold War both very much from a personal standpoint, and I wanted to go back. I'd covered the end of the collapse of the Berlin Wall, but I really wanted to know what brought it about in the first place, and was there anything that we did where we were complicit in the construction of the Berlin Wall, and could we have done anything to avoid it?
Can you recall on your initial visit to see your family when you were a student, can you recall what sort of apprehension you had about traveling to East Germany? Or did you have any?
Well, I was stopped at Checkpoint Charlie, and you know, everything was removed from my bag, and I was patted down. I was kept there for 2 or 3 hours. My address book was removed from me. They went through it entirely, and so you were apprehensive, even though you didn't really know why.
Yeah,
I didn't think they were going to throw me in jail. I hadn't committed any crime, but yet just the feeling of crossing that border made you feel somehow, in some form, criminal. When I came back out. And in those days, every day, every couple of days, you had to report into the local police station. And so visiting my relatives, just the fact I had to report into the police station would remind them, you know, this is someone whose visit does not necessarily help your status in this country.
Yeah.
So there were a myriad of different things that would happen to you when you were behind the Berlin Wall that made you feel that Big Brother was always watching. And in this case, it was the Stasi, the state security organization, which we now know, in terms of personnel, was much larger per capita than the Gestapo ever was during the Third Reich.
Frederick Kemp is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council and a 25-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. Fred, it's been a really interesting hour. I really appreciate you making time for us.
Fascinating chat, Chris. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.